Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a series of short discussions on various topics related to the Microsoft Cloud Platform. Your hosts, Kale Teeter, Evan Basilek, and Sujit Mallow, discuss a specific topic on each show to give you a high-level overview of that topic, and resources to get more information should you wish to dig further. For more information on our show, please see our website at azpodcast.com. Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 201, being recorded on the 25th of October, 2017, with special guest Krista Swory. I'm Sujit, and on Skype with me, I have Kale, Evan, Russell, and our special guest, Krista. And of course, before we get started with Krista on a really exciting topic today, let's just do a quick roundup on the latest news in the Azure space. And seems to be a pretty busy week, guys. Thanks for putting all those links in the show notes. Who wants to start?
I think we want to get straight on with content computing. Skip the announcements, get to the interesting stuff.
That would be great, no doubt about it.
I guess, they're, like you say, there's quite a lot of interesting stuff out this week. The one that caught my eye as quite interesting was the AKS, the Azure Kubernetes Service. So we've had this container service for quite some time now, which allows you to provision clusters and set those up, supporting Mesos and Docker OS and Swarm on top of it. And we put Kubernetes support into that a while ago. But this announcement today is a more fully managed service around containers run managed for you as well, so you don't have to worry about any of the VMs at all, and we'll set the whole thing up and manage it for you. So it's much more of a platform service feel to it than an IaaS cluster, and it's just running Kubernetes in there as well. So I think Kubernetes has kind of become the industry standard nowadays.
I saw one interesting reference where it talked about that, basically saying, and I'm paraphrasing a little bit, but it basically said, you know, Google, you know, created Kubernetes, it has absolutely become the standard, but you know, now you've got Microsoft coming in actually making it significantly easier to use and deploy, and that's going to cause some real interesting pushes on both sides for improvements in the capabilities and the platform, right? So it's a nice synergy at that point to drive overall improvement in that, but it's really interesting to see us come in and add significant value on this open source tooling.
Yeah, I mean, from what I understand from reading the post on it should make the scaling and the whole rolling out and provisioning really, really simple now, and faster as well. And one thing they've done on the back of this as well is one-click setup for container registry geo-replication. So you can now just go in like you can with Azure SQL and some of the other services and just point on another region that you want to pair with, and it will go and replicate and set up your container images to go over to those registries as well. So yeah, going big on containers this week.
That's really interesting stuff right there. And what about this Cray supercomputer coming to Azure?
I got to talk about that because I was thinking about this. Back in the day when I was still a chemical engineer, I actually used, you know, computational fluid dynamics and the like to do the simulations. And I remember when we were all excited, because I don't remember how many tens of thousands of dollars we spent like to have like 8 cores doing something. And we were just thrilled because we could do, you know, much higher fidelity stuff faster. And, you know, like these Cray supercomputers, I mean, you're talking thousands and thousands and thousands of cores. I mean, I cannot even imagine the complexity of what you're able to model. And now, again, similar to what we were talking about with the Kubernetes stuff, right, taking away a lot of the complexity of standing up the cluster and managing that cluster, that's huge.
That's amazing news right there. And I guess we missed this piece of update from last week, but the availability zones, I don't think we spoke about that, did we? We may have missed it. That's something that's been... I think we've been waiting for it for a while. It's something that ensures that we don't take a single, if in case we lose a specific data center, you don't lose your service. You could still, if it's in an availability zone, it will switch over to the other data center in that particular region, because every region is made up of at least 3 data centers. And so that's something that'll be very interesting. I'm just definitely looking forward to it.
Yeah, and I got the blockchain angles again this week. So these were posted by me actually on Azure. So the first one's Truffle, which is a DevOps SDK framework tool that's used by developers to build decentralized apps. So we made the choice to put the version 4, which is in beta right now. So we have basically the LTS version or the stable version there, which is version 3, and now we have 4 as well in this beta mode, because one of the reasons is because it brings some crazy features, like we can do step-through debugging. I know that might be not crazy to people on the call saying, what do you mean you couldn't do that before? It was very hard to do that in a blockchain. And so this brings some of those features to the table. The other one was a company, a partner we're working with, BLK, who has built a composite service for ERC-20 tokens, which is basically a token standard for digital assets, on top of Quorum, on top of Azure. So this is really cool. It's a REST kind of interface that allows you to, you know, basically work with a web service and interact with these digital asset tokens. So really good for enterprises who want to work with digital assets and those kind of models in their business apps.
So I just have to call this out, Cale. You know, I think it's cheating when you write your own articles.
These are awesome articles, by the way. No,
I was jealous. I was wondering how to get your own stuff up there. So I've been trying to get some hints off Cale lately.
That's cool.
And one last one then, Sujit, that I noticed on there was just a simplified process for doing replication of VMs via site recovery. So you can now go in the portal and just, similar to what I was saying earlier with the container registry stuff, you can go and identify another region by going to the disaster recovery menu item on your panel for your VM. Say, I want it over in that region, click a button, and off it goes, replicates, and you're done. So that's quite a nice little feature, just simplifying that whole process for you again.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. All right, great. So I think that's a quick roundup of all the Azure space. Anything else you guys want to pick up, or shall we just move on to interesting things?
No, let's talk about quantum.
Okay, so let's. We have a special guest, Krista Swory. Krista, would you mind introducing yourself and give us a background as to what you are currently doing at Microsoft?
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me on the podcast today. I'm Krista Savori, and I lead the Quantum Architecture and Computation Group, which is part of the Microsoft Quantum Program here. We're located in Redmond, and my team specifically is looking at how do you program a quantum computer. You know, what does the software stack look like? Everything from programming language to compilers to optimizers, you know, all the way down to the runtime and how you would communicate with the hardware. And then we also look at what will you do with a quantum computer. So what are the algorithms and applications? And we work on developing those algorithms and applications, you know, for problems where you're looking for, you know, huge, huge speed ups by using a quantum device instead of your classical machines today.
So I remember hearing about quantum computers on the Starship Enterprise. What can you remind me what exactly is a quantum computer?
Yeah, it's a great question. Yeah, so we won't be teleporting a human, you know, out to other spaceships anytime soon. But you know, a quantum computer, it's really a new and exciting form of computing. So it's really a paradigm shift for computing that allows us to go exponentially beyond the capabilities of even our best supercomputers. So I know, you know, earlier in the podcast, we were talking about the Cray supercomputer. So, you know, in these cases, a quantum computer, you know, for certain problems can actually outperform, we're talking, you know, billions of years of improvement in terms of the time to solution over timescales we would see on a supercomputer for certain problems. And a quantum computer, you know, the idea is it's actually grounded in the principles of quantum mechanics. So, you know, at its core, it's operating very, very differently than our digital computers today. Really, quantum mechanics, of course, underlies the fundamental theory of nature at the smallest, you know, atomic and subatomic scales. So we harness that. We harness quantum mechanics to actually build the device and then compute on the device. So it's quantum mechanics that's really governing how we store and process information in the quantum computer.
So that I missed out on quantum physics and mechanics at school. I didn't do any of that kind of stuff. So I've just been looking at it recently and really getting confused and trying to get back to basics with it and trying to figure out what's going on in there. But I think the thing that, you know, when I get really excited about it and I can understand the, you know, these massive improvements in terms of speed and compute power and what have you. But when I'm talking to people about it, the first thing they come back with is, okay, so what's the real life, you know, scenario for this? What's the real life use case for it? So what are the things that, you know, are coming to mind first for you?
Yeah, so, you know, what I'm most excited about with quantum computing is that we can unlock solutions to problems that are extremely hard to solve classically. So we're talking about some problems that take billions of years or lifetime of the universe timescales to get a solution. And it turns out these problems exist all over today, and they are some of the most important and most challenging problems we face. So we're looking at problems in, you know, how do we combat global warming? How do we come up with better clean energy solutions? These types of problems require that we actually simulate physical systems and understand chemical reactions and processes, right? And to understand these types of reactions and chemical processes, we have to simulate those processes on a computer. And like I said, classically, you know, many of these problems to get the solution requires billions of years. On a quantum computer, it's actually, you know, as I mentioned, it's based on quantum mechanics. So it's actually really well paired to quantum mechanical problems. And so it allows us to seek solutions for catalysis problems. So we want to find a catalyst that allows us to more efficiently extract carbon from the environment, for example. On a quantum computer, we can study that problem and hope to identify a catalyst much more efficiently than one could do using our classical computers or all the world's classical computers working in parallel.
So Krista, something that comes to mind for me when I'm talking about this next generation type processing power is, like, what are some of the, like, challenges? I mean, quantum, the idea of a quantum computer has been around for some time, but obviously there's some huge challenges to, like, bringing something like this to market or even making it something that a normal user could use, have sitting under their desk. Maybe you could speak to, like, what are some of the, like, the huge kind of physical challenges around building something like this type of computer?
Yeah, sure. It's a great question. There's a whole stack of challenges, right, throughout the whole hardware and software stack. And so, in fact, at Microsoft, we're targeting and inventing in all of these areas. And I'd say we've really come up with a set of breakthroughs that enables us to make significant progress in actually building out the machine, where building this quantum computer means building the hardware and building the software. And we really are doing that in a kind of a co-developed manner. So in terms of what's required, you know, at the core, we need a way to store and compute the information in this machine. And so classically, of course, we refer to these as bits, right? We have bits in our machines today, and those are binary. In the quantum computer, we have the analogous qubit, a quantum bit, quantum bits. So we call them qubits. And the approach we're taking at Microsoft is to actually develop a fundamentally distinct type of qubit that's very, very robust to noise. So quantum computers, these qubits, they're very fragile. And we want a very strong, robust, noise-resistant qubit as the foundation for our quantum computer. So we're working on building those. Our approach is called a topological qubit, and it should save us several orders of magnitude in resources as we build up the complete machine. And then from there, so these qubits, they sit at millikelvin temperatures, so they sit around 10 to 20 millikelvin. So it's almost, very close to absolute zero. On top of that, then, you think, well, these qubits in this really cold environment, how do I interact with them, right? How am I going to control them and read them out? So you need a complete stack then of other hardware and software that actually sits in a cryogenic environment. So we're also working on a cryogenic classical computer that's unlike any classical computer we've had before, that operates at around 4 Kelvin. Right, that's around 459.
Like super warm then, relatively
yeah.
speaking.
Yeah, super warm, minus 459 degrees Fahrenheit. Super warm for the rest of us. But so we're actually also engineering that cryogenic classical computer, and then of course all the software that will sit on that classical computer. And that cryogenic classical computer will help control and read out the quantum computer that sits, at millikelvin. And then at room temperature, of course, we have our standard machines, which we'll use to program, send down the programs and write our code. So the other key thing we're developing, and my group in particular has been working on this, is the software, right, that we're going to use to program the quantum computer. And at the highest level, and highest temperatures, room temperature, you'll be programming this quantum computer. And we've developed an entirely new language, specifically, really suited to programming a quantum computer and suited to the types of operations you perform on a quantum computer. And with this new language, we've integrated it into Visual Studio. So with that, it brings the ability to debug and other Visual Studio extensions, syntax coloring, and so forth. And then we've also brought to the software stack a local simulator, which allows you to really debug and test your quantum applications and code before you run it on the full hardware. And then with our software stack, we also have a wonderful extensive community site that has samples, tutorials, libraries of code, and we'll have regular updates to our software stack over time. And in terms of the software itself, the software, we're releasing it in preview, the key layers of the software stack by the end of the year for free.
That's wow, pretty okay. amazing, yeah.
You talked about simulator there, so that runs locally on a laptop alongside your Visual Studio, so you can debug locally or
exactly, yeah. So in fact, we have two versions of the simulator, and maybe just to what does a simulator mean in this context, right? So. Mm. In terms of a simulator here, we're simulating the operations of the quantum computer, and we're doing that on the classical computer. And our local simulator enables you to simulate more than 30 qubits, so around 30 qubits in 16 gigabytes of classical memory. Now, 30 qubits, that sounds like a small number, right? But what's important to recognize is adding 10 qubits. So let's go to 40 qubits. And now I want to simulate those 40 qubits. That requires 1,000 times more memory.
Wow.
So you're looking at then 16 terabytes to simulate 40 qubits, and then add 10 more, it's another 1,000 times the memory. So as you scale up to say you want 230 qubits, well, that requires a classical memory of 10 to the 80 bytes, which just for reference, that's larger than the number of particles in our visible universe. So that shows you why you want a quantum computer, right? 230 qubits is more powerful, in terms of if we were to use our universe as a computer, 230 qubits is more powerful than using our universe as a computer. Now, going back to our simulators then, of course, can't scale, as we talked about, too much beyond, 40-ish qubits. So locally, 16 gigs of classical memory, you get 30 qubits of simulation, double the memory for each additional qubit you add. And we also offer an Azure-based simulator, which allows you to simulate more than 40 qubits. And as I mentioned, 40 qubits requires about 16 terabytes. Add one more qubit, it doubles the amount of memory required for simulation. But now in both of these environments, you can debug your code, you can step through, small examples of the algorithms running on the hardware and start to understand what the scaling looks like for different problems and so forth. So it's pretty powerful.
So let me go back, because the scaling numbers are amazing, right? We talk about cloud computing is offering incredible scale. This is, you know, a whole nother yeah. level past that. But,
yeah.
but I thought I heard you say by the end of the year you thought you'd have, you know, some preview type code out there. I mean, that means this is way past theoretical and testing. I mean, this is something that by the end of the year people will be able to put their hands on to some extent.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's to the point we're actually developing a whole software stack that we're bringing out, putting out for the community to really engage people, engage developers, people that don't know quantum computing. The point of our software stack is really that it's accessible to a broader community. Because after all, we want to learn and identify, you know, what will the quantum applications of tomorrow look like? I mentioned a few areas earlier, you know, of course, in carbon capture, nitrogen fixation, fertilizer production, you know, the global warming, clean energy, these types of problems. We also know that quantum computing will help in machine learning and artificial intelligence and yield speed ups and better models there. So I'm really excited to see what a broader community will come up with in terms of quantum applications. And so the whole idea is to get these tools into the hands of developers, researchers, academics, students, right? Quantum enthusiasts, you know, people that were once a physicist and are now doing other things. And, you know, all of these types of people, everyone out there, we want to be able to use these tools. And part of that, you know, in putting it in Visual Studio, it makes it much more accessible and familiar to really start developing. So yeah, this is real, right? Where quantum computing is coming, and we believe it's going to be truly revolutionary for our compute, that we use today.
Krista, is this being developed as part of some sort of a standard, like an ECMO standard, so that, you know, today, tomorrow, if some other company comes up with their quantum computer, is that going to have a completely different language and, I don't know, methodology of working with it? Or is there some overall standard that we're trying to adhere to?
Yeah, I think, you know, that's a really great question. And that's a question that we're just starting to explore with other companies and what that should look like for this field and this kind of arena, right? And so we're just on the cusp of exploring that. And we've had discussions there. And I think we'll know a lot more about, you know, what that, you know, if there is a standard, if we look to a standards body, you know, what that will look like in the coming months. So we'll definitely be updating the community with information there over time.
Well, one of the things I saw that was quite interesting, you talked about the language code and the samples and stuff up there. I saw your Hello World sample. And going back to, you know, one of your first opening statements is we're not going to be teleporting people just yet. But it looked like that was what the Hello World sample was doing.
Well, so. Yeah. Exactly. Hello World. The Hello World example, we like to call quantum teleportation, you know, the Hello World of quantum computing. It's really one of the great first examples where you can see how qubits can, see some of the key quantum mechanical properties of the quantum bits of the qubits and how those operations work in the quantum environment. So it's really a great first piece of code to try to write and understand to step in and learn more about quantum. And indeed, it's quantum teleportation. So what happens is you want to take a bit, some bit of information, and you want to send it, you know, to someone who's gone across the universe. And the whole idea is that that can happen instantaneously on the quantum side. Now, of course, I need a classical bit that I send to my friend across the universe. So it still is limited by the speed of light. But it's a great first example. So yes, we can teleport information for sure. And you can write code to teleport that information in our software stack. Human beings are going to be a little bit harder.
Just a 3D scanner, surely.
Yeah, exactly. We need the 3D quantum printer or something.
So I mean, what are we talking in terms of, you know, the quantum computer that you're talking about, this stack of different hardware through the different temperature layers and stuff? When you know, how far is the timescale before we see something like that actually appear and work and run?
Yeah, well, so in fact, you know, we already have, you know, components of this stack today. And, you know, in the news, people have seen that there are, you know, there are qubits today. They're running in these cold environments. We have, you know, many dilution refrigerators that where quantum computers, you know, are shown. In our type of qubit, the type of qubit we're working on, we have exhibited a brand new, you know, a pretty exotic area of physics, and harnessed that physics. And now we're taking it to the level of showing that that type of physics that underlies our qubit can actually be used to store information and compute. So we're working on producing this topological qubit that's going to be far more robust than the other types of qubits we have today. But indeed, quantum computers at a very small scale exist today that use other types of qubits. And so, yeah, these are real.
Okay. So I'll have one by Christmas, shall I, on my Christmas list?
Yeah, well, to put it in your house, you're going to need quite a bit of, you know, different gases and environments. So,
but just because it's
start the construction.
Just because it requires all these special environmental things in place, I guess that makes it more conducive to host in Azure, right, where people don't really need to worry about that. They just get access to it remotely.
Right, exactly. So the idea with a quantum computer, it does sit in what's called a dilution refrigerator. And these dilution refrigerators are quite large. You know, they're larger than a human being, and require, you know, require a special environment. And so indeed, what we envision is that the quantum, you know, quantum computers will essentially augment our heterogeneous cloud, right? So today we already have a very heterogeneous cloud consisting of FPGAs and GPUs and CPUs, right? You have access to all of these different types of compute. And quantum computing will be another type of compute that that is an option that you would access through a cloud type environment. So indeed, that's how we see access to a quantum computer. You're not going to have a quantum computer sitting on your desktop, or it's not going to be your near-term mobile device or anything like that, right? It's definitely more of a special purpose piece of hardware that you'll call for certain problems to get speed ups or improved models or otherwise. Now, we like to joke that because a quantum computer is good at understanding and modeling materials, and in fact, our quantum computer relies on superconductivity and superconducting materials. The big kind of one of the jokes in the field is that we're going to use our first quantum computer to design the next quantum computer that won't need to be cold, right? So someday we may have the quantum computer sitting at room temperature, and we may see quite an evolution from there. But for now, it needs to be cold, and definitely we envision the quantum computer as another compute option in the cloud.
So this is, I mean, it's going to be a massive step change, isn't it, between what we have now with all that compute power. Is there kind of a worry to the fact that it could be used for things like getting rid of or cracking encryption, so all those kinds of things that take a lot of processing at the moment, and being used for sort of, you know, not good purposes, but malicious purposes?
Yeah, well, you raise a great point. So indeed, you know, one of the earliest applications shown for a quantum computer, it was shown by Peter Shor in the early 1990s. And what he showed was that a quantum computer can break, for example, RSA. Our RSA cryptosystem. Now, RSA, of course, is essentially, you know, a mainstay of e-commerce today. Almost every time you're putting your credit card on the internet, you know, your many of the protocols underlying the internet and so forth rely on RSA. Now, the key is that, you know, many governments and NIST, for example, here in the United States, has put out a call for proposals. I think the call just concluded for proposals that will be of crypto systems that will be robust against quantum attacks. So RSA is susceptible to a quantum computer attack, but other crypto systems we don't think are. And so the move now is to move to what we call post-quantum crypto. So the idea will be to move our protocols to a crypto system that's robust against quantum computing. It's still a classical crypto system, but it can't be broken by a quantum computer, you know, or right. Or at least we don't have evidence it can, right? In crypto, there are no proofs of these things. But indeed, we would show that, you know, we don't see any quantum attacks for the system, and then we would move to that system. And there are several great proposals out there, several proposals coming out of Microsoft in particular. Brian Lamacchia here at Microsoft, his team in security and privacy have several proposals that look to be indeed robust against quantum attacks. And so we'll see an evolution. And I think it's important for companies and customers and governments and others to realize that for this post-quantum crypto move, you know, we have to start moving our software now. It's going to take, you know, likely a decade to change over all the protocols in the software we use today to another type of protocol. And so indeed, we do need to be aware now to maintain kind of more modular, flexible software that enables us to change crypto protocols as we learn you know, robustness of protocols, whether that's a quantum attack or a classical attack, you know, we should have the ability to change and migrate to a new protocol as we learn more. So indeed, that process should start now. And we're the identification of the protocol to move to is well underway right now, as I mentioned.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, that's fascinating.
That's amazing, Krista. Thank you so much for all this great information. I feel like I understood a little bit about quantum computing today. So really
oh, excellent.
It.
Well, let me just encourage the listeners to sign up to gain access to our software preview. You can sign up at microsoft.com/quantum.
Awesome. Thank you again. And if you know, if you want to share any other links with us, please let me have them, and I'll put them in the show notes along with this podcast.
Fantastic. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions for Krista before we let her go, guys?
No, that's been great. I mean, I've been, like I said, I've been looking at resources up on the web, but it's nice to hear it from the horse's mouth and get answers to direct questions, which is great. Thank you.
My pleasure.
All right. Thanks again.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any comments or questions, please use our Twitter handle @AzurePodcasts. Background music has been taken from ccmixter.org under the Creative Commons license. Thank you, and see you next time.